Warning, the Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Listening to on the Savage Nation is one of the most astonishing concession speeches in the history of American sports. That is the great Mexican-American fighter Chris Arreola, 6'4", 245 pounds, after withdrawing, his team withdrew him in the 10th round of a heavyweight bout against Vitaly Klitschko, the Russian gladiator at 6'7", who also holds a PhD in sports science. Now, the reason I'm playing this is because when I watched that fight, and I saw this bruising gladiator, Chris Arreola, crying because he had to withdraw from the fight from having taken too much punishment. I had not seen anything like this since, I don't know, since I was a kid. I've not seen fighters cry. But why was he crying? He was crying because he had shame. And the reason he had shame is because he has pride. And the reason he had pride is because he respects himself. And the reason he had shame is because he failed his audience of Mexican-American supporters in the crowd at the Staples Center when he had to withdraw in a TKO in the 10th round. And it brings me back to America today. We're living in the twilight zone of America. Why do I say that? This was once a nation that liked to win, a nation that took pride in winning, a nation that strove for victory. And we succeeded beyond the wildest dreams of all other nations precisely because we strove to be the best and would be ashamed to be anything less. And what happened to this nation? For the last 40 years, the liberals have come along and said all that was wrong. Liberals said that it was victory that held shame. Liberals taught that there was no such thing as winning or losing. Liberals wanted to preserve self-esteem above all. Instead of achieving the esteem of the world, they wanted self-esteem. And so now we have entered, as I say, the twilight zone of American agitation. We don't know whether we won or we lost in Iraq. We don't know whether we're winning or losing in Afghanistan. We don't know whether we won victory or defeat against Iran. We don't know whether we won or lost against North Korea. Now, there are some men in America, though, who still know the difference between winning and losing. In a boxing ring, there's very little compromise. I saw one of them the other night after the boxing match, Chris Arreola. He had been defeated by his opponent in the 10th round. I'm talking about a man 6'4" and 245 pounds. And he was ashamed of losing. He was so ashamed he was crying in front of the whole world. Can you imagine that in the leftist America of today, being ashamed of losing? You see, Chris didn't want to give up, but his manager threw in the towel for him. In the same way that our spineless leaders have thrown in the towel for America. The left wing has told us that there are no winners or losers. But in the boxing ring, there are clearly winners or losers. At the end of the match, Chris Arreola vowed that he would come back and do better next time. His loss and his shame girded him for the next fight. And that is what we must do as a nation. We must hang our heads when we lose, but we must seek triumph and seek victory and seek to win. We cannot permit the compromised political class to carry us along in this twilight zone of America. Play that clip again of Chris Arreola, one of the most astonishing concession speeches I have ever heard in the history of American sports. Please play it.
Chris, a brave effort. Why did it fall short?
I don't know, man. I just want to say I'm sorry to everybody, man. I really wanted to be a champion today, man. And I worked my ass off. Vitaly's a strong. He hits hard. And I never wanted to quit, man. That's never in me. I didn't want to quit. I wanted to go the full 12 rounds. I know it's me up, but hey, I'm sorry, guys.
So you didn't want it to be stopped, but obviously your trainer and the referee felt that you were taking too much punishment and you were not able to get to him in any way consistently.
I couldn't get to him, man. He was fighting the fight he was supposed to fight. He ran when he was supposed to. I just couldn't get to him, man.
Now, no fighter of Mexican-American heritage or of Mexican heritage has ever won a heavyweight championship. Arreola was determined to be the first. He came in that ring, and he fought a man who was bigger than him, stronger than him, and, frankly, more skilled than him. And when he lost, as I say, he was heartbroken, and his shame for his people and his loss was amazing. Now, I don't want to take this any, you know, much further than I've taken it, but I was moved by this, and I was moved to think about this once proud nation and how it's been brought to its knees by the compromised political class. When did it start? When did we first become compromised? Some would say, well, it goes back to Vietnam. Some would say it was the shameful withdrawal from Vietnam as a result of this, of the knife in the back from Walter Cronkite and the political, and the journalist class who said we had lost when we didn't lose. Some would say it began with Nixon. Others would say it began with Clinton and his compromised morality. Next, people would say it began with George Bush and his compromised so-called victory in Iraq, which is really a victory for the military-industrial complex. And now, of course, we have the most compromised presidency in American history with Barack Obama, who has just said yesterday, I don't even want victory in Iran, with Iran. I'm not seeking victory against Iran. Do you have that soundbite? Because you're not going to believe this. Here is
a president. So I'm not interested in victory. I'm interested in resolving. The problem is that Iran repeatedly says that it's pursuing nuclear energy only for peaceful purposes, and its actions contradict its words.
So here is a man who is the leader of the free world, the commander-in-chief, who sends troops to die for America, and now he says he's not interested in victory with Iran. He's interested in resolving the problem. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? I think maybe men could understand this better than women, and I'm not trying to pander to men or put down women, but I got to tell you, when I heard that man cry, I watched the fight last night after finishing my book. In fact, I watched too much television, I will admit. I watched nonstop television late at night. I couldn't sleep. I was so agitated from seeing what's going on with America, with Britain, with France, with Germany. I see an entire Western democratic slate falling apart because of the compromised political vermin who are running these countries. I'm sorry to say, you think I enjoy saying it? Can you name one person running one Western nation who you look up to? I can't. It's not just Obama. Look what went on the other day. Iran sneers and spits in the face of the West and says, there is no Holocaust when everybody knows what happened. Then they say we're going to get nuclear weapons and you can't stop us. Then Time magazine gets on their hands and knees and licks his boots. Then he says to Obama, you'll regret what you just did. So in order to outsmart or outflank the Hitler of our time, Obama comes out with a speech along with Gordon Brown, the pillhead, and Sarkozy, the skirt chaser, and says, well, we knew about it all along. They didn't know anything. Our intelligence communities have failed us once again. Remember the national intelligence estimate about a year or two ago that came out and said Iran was not developing a weapon? Do you remember the big news blast across the liberal networks that we were all lying, Iran was not developing weapons? Now tell me, who was it in the National Intelligence Estimate Committee? I can name a few names. They were all over every left-wing media outlet in the world saying they're one, you should round them up and the government should try them for treason. Half of them worked for the Defense Department. The other half worked for the CIA. The other portion of them worked for another intelligence agency. And every last one of them was a yellow-bellied red commie. That's my opinion, and that's why we are a compromised nation, because we have compromised vermin rising to the top. As I was taught as a child, all you had to do was go out to a beach in a dirty city in the morning, and you'll see what floats with the incoming tide. And that's what floats to the top of the political structure. I'll be right back.
Savage.
And to use your superior speed, hand speed on the inside. What did he do to neutralize that?
Why did he? Whatever I did, he'd find a way to counteract that. And he just found a way to win, and I'll find a way to lose.
I think you gained a lot of fans in losing here and for giving a great effort. Thank you very much, Chris.
This ain't the largest you to me. That, I'm coming back.
Now, that's the heart of a man. That's a warrior. I mean, if you've seen movies like Rocky or The Harder They Fall, whatever the movie was, they were actors playing at this role. Here's a man not playing at the role of being a warrior who lost. But how often have you seen a warrior of this magnitude crying in the ring, not because he was physically hurt, because he certainly got beaten a little bit, but he wasn't as badly battered as some I've seen, but because his pride was injured more than anything. In other words, his pride is what hurts, and he was ashamed he had to quit in front of his fans. And I go back again to my principal idea here, which is that we're living in America, an America that's in the twilight zone. We used to be a nation that won. And something happened now where we elect men and women who only know compromise, because these are the compromised people of America. They're all lawyers. 99% of these politicians are lawyers who believe in compromise and working out so-called deals. And we all walk around somewhat ashamed of being an American. We think that we stepped in something dirty. We don't know what to do with our shoes. None of us really feel pride in being an American anymore. And we keep electing these compromised critters. And look what we have now. Here is a man, Obama, who traveled around the world to apologize for everything America that never did. He went all the way to the Middle East to say, I'm sorry to these demonic figures in the Middle East. And he got down on his hands and knees. And what happened? What happened to Barack Obama? What happened to the result? What was the result of him begging for forgiveness in the Middle East? Well, what happened was a third round of testing of medium-range missiles that can hit not only Israel, Eastern Europe, and Middle Eastern nations, but several U.S. military bases as well. And Venezuela, his good friend Chavez, who embraced him in the U.N., Venezuela and the dictator of Venezuela says it's working now with Russia and Iran in finding sources of uranium to build nuclear weapons. And what about his good friends in China? China says it will display new upgraded missiles to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the founding of Red China. And what about India? India now announces that it can now make nuclear weapons up to a strength of 200 kilotons, four times over the line that the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty pledges signing nations not to cross. And this is what Barack Hussein Obama told us would never happen if he were elected. This is what Barack Hussein Obama told us would never happen when he came to power. This is the president who promised us unity and brought us nothing but disunity. This is the president who went around to apologize to the world and instead got a slapping around that nobody ever thought a president would take. And so, as I say to you, when I watch a fight between two heavyweights of this size, 6'4", 245 pounds, against Vitali Klitschko, 6'7". Now, if you don't know who I'm talking about, Chris Arreola is built like a refrigerator, like a tank. Vitali Klitschko is older, taller, 4 inches more in his hand reach from the shoulder to the armpit to the end of his fist. But he's also built like a Greek god. He has a perfect face to go with it, and he has an earned PhD in sports science. He's a highly technical boxer, and the other guy couldn't get near him. In fact, I remember meeting Klitschko at a fight in Vegas a while ago, and he was one of the nicest gentlemen I've ever really had the honor to meet. And I asked him something about fighting, and he said to me, I said to him, how much of this is mental? And he looked at me and he said, it's all mental, Michael. It's all mental. Now let's move on to the callers. My basic thesis is that we need to get rid of these compromised leaders. We need men and we need women who know what winning is. We want no more compromise. Joe in New York, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Savage, it is an honor to talk to you. You have articulated in a brief 5 minutes what's been driving me crazy as a father for the past 10 years, raising children in the suburbs of New York. They don't keep score in the sports until they're a certain age, and everything is about making the kids feel good, that everybody's
yeah.
the same.
Yeah, everyone's equal. Everyone's equal. Sure, they're all equal. We all know that.
Dr. Savage, you have to keep yelling out. The president's going over to a country to bring the Olympics over that is it's in the midst of this Sharia law that's being spread all over Europe. But that needs to be yelled out more.
But where does he want the Olympics? No, he wants the Olympics in Chicago because of the billions of dollars there.
Oh, into Denmark.
Yeah. You know, here's a president who's supposedly the commander-in-chief who has met the general in Afghanistan, Mr. McChrystal, General McChrystal, only once in 70 days, but he's had unlimited time to talk to special interest groups for each of those 70 days. What does that tell you about Barack Hussein Obama's priorities? Let's hear the mm-mm-mm. I want to hear the mm-mm-mm. I need the mm-mm-mm in order to get the show going. There you go. Give it again. Give it again, Sam. Mm-mm-mm. Colorado, Tim, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
How you doing, Mike? I just wanted to say, correct me if I'm wrong, did you say Barack insane Obama? Because I think that's what I heard. Mike, we met a long time ago, and the first thing I said to you back then was, you're not bad for a moderate liberal. I have a son who's getting ready to deploy on his fourth tour, and this guy...
Wait, hold on. What did you call, to insult me? Or I don't know what you're saying here. What, you don't like me, or you do like me? What do you mean I'm not a moderate? Now I'm a moderate liberal to you? What does that make you, Hitler?
No, Mike, we met a long time ago, and that was the first line I ever said to you, and you just... At the time, you about fell on the floor laughing your rear end off at me.
I don't know what you're saying, though. What is it you're saying, Tim? You're not making sense. Try to be my friend here. What are you saying?
I'm saying that I have...
All right, have a nice day. Whatever.
Met me long. Savage.
Well, this isn't a football game, so I'm not interested in victory. I'm interested in resolving. The problem is that Iran repeatedly says that it's pursuing nuclear energy only for peaceful purposes, and its actions contradict its words.
And what are you going to do about it, Mr. Obama? You are the commander-in-chief, not the salesman-in-chief for Chicago politics. You're going to travel to Denmark to peddle the Olympics instead of staying home and protecting America? Mr. Obama, you are the leader of the free world, and you're not acting like a leader of the free world. You need to tell Iran in no uncertain terms that they're going to lose and we're going to win. They're beating us down mentally before the fight. By not firing a shot, they're beating us down because they understand warfare. They understand the psychological element of warfare, and they're winning and we're losing. For example, the defense secretary, who I've never seen a change like this in my life. Never in my life have I seen anything like it. Did you hear what the defense secretary said the other day? He said, well, we really can't do anything about it. We can't really do much about it, says Defense Secretary Gates. The Iranians obviously think that they've got Obama's number. They understand that this weakling liberal diplomacy is not working. And they know that the softer that the diplomacy appears, the softer we really are. Robert M. Gates, the president's defense secretary, says, he admits that Ahmadinejad is definitely going to build nuclear weapons, but then he says, we don't know what we can do about it except talk to him some more. He says, quote, the reality is there is no military option that does anything more than buy time. Really? Isn't that what we need is buy time? Couldn't we use the military option to buy time? And when that time runs out, when in 5 years or 7 years from now, when the Iranian Hitler and his minions try to build a weapon again, couldn't we use another B-2 bomber mission to buy another 5 years? Isn't that what a military is for? In other words, what do we have a military for but to buy time? There's always going to be another threat. All a military action ever does is buy time. So here we have a complete and total lack of reality going on in this country. And the fact is that Obama sounded weak in what he just said. It was actually sad to listen to him when he says, oh, why? He almost sounded like he was crying, actually, when you think about it. He almost sounded like a schoolboy crying when he said, oh, they're building weapons and we don't like it and we're not going to do anything, but we're going to not like it some more. We've gone from give me liberty or give me death, Patrick Henry, to give me penury and give me death panels under Obama. From give me liberty or give me death, the new mantra of America is give me penury and give me death panels. You know, I'm involved in a battle right now that I didn't choose. Many of us don't understand this. I did not choose the battle I am involved in. Listen to me. Just listen to me for a minute. I'm a single man fighting an entire nation. They have all the resources at their disposal. That is the Britain under Gordon Brown, the pillhead. The pillhead has all of his sycophants from Oxford, from Cambridge, working for him. And the pillhead said, put Michael Savage on the banned list in order to balance the list. Put him on the list because he's not a Muslim. Put him on the list because he's not a liberal. Put him on the list because he's a nationalist. Put him on the list because he believes in borders, language, and culture. Put that man on the list. Nobody will come to his defense. I did not choose this fight, but I want to tell you that the fate of more than a single man hangs in the balance, because I am going to win this fight, and I'm going to win this fight without the help of those in the media. I'm going to win this fight with the help of the American people and with certain spiritual forces that I'm gathering right now that I cannot tell you about. But this man, Gordon Brown, is a spiritualist, neo-Marxist, if you want to put it that, to yourself that way. And the core of him is empty. There's an emptiness at the heart of this man. I'm going to defeat that government as sure as I'm sitting here, whether it's in the near term or in the long term. And when I get up in front of the Cambridge Union on October 15th and that bell rings, I can guarantee you that this guy from the Bronx is going to go out, and I'm going to run out there and I'm going to state my case. I'm going to state my case for freedom of speech. I'm going to state my case for America. And I'm going to state my case for my own dignity and my own honor. Yeah, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to fight Goliath. They've made me into a David. I didn't ask for this fight. I did not choose this fight, but I have to fight this fight. And that's the end of it. They put me in a list with all I am is one of America's most beloved radio talk show hosts. I mean, let's level with each other here. I've got a lot of listeners, and they take a man who's a politics they don't like, and they link me up with Russian skinheads in prison for murdering 10 immigrants and a Hamas murderer who executed two Jewish parents and crushed in the head of their four-year-old daughter after they were dead. These are criminals. So why would they put me on a list with criminals? Because it's the continuing erosion of freedom of speech in the United Kingdom and in America and in all nations where these liberties were supposedly granted to us with our birthright. And it's being done under the dirty veil of political correctness. My continued dedication to the principles of borders, language, and culture seems like a great threat to these compromised leaders. Admittedly, when I get angry, I may not reflect the keen and cool facade of British gentility, but let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen of the Savage Nation, I have Savile Row in my soul. I have Savile Row in my soul. So I am now a threat to the government. I am now a threat to the British government. I am now a threat to the U.S. government. I am now a thought criminal. My ideas and thoughts are so powerful that they lead people to put me on a list with murderers. History has shown us that when injustice is done to a man or to a nation, the people will rebel, and often violently. That's right. They will often violently rebel. When the people are not heard, they're going to be heard one way or another. You saw that with the town hall meetings. You saw thousands, if not millions, of people standing up to these compromised vermin. And now it's my turn. Because if I don't stand up for my civil liberties, and if I don't stand up for my freedom of speech, this is the road to the tyrants of the past. This is the road to the tyrants of the present. This is the road to Hugo Chavez in America. This is the road to Ahmadinejad of Iran. This is the road to the Castro brothers taking over Cuba. Rulers, when given an inch, will run thousands of miles, perhaps right through our own homes. And that's why I disagree with this horrendous, linking me up with murderers, with these people in England who did this to me. Radio and free speech are in a more perilous state today than ever. In South America, we have the dictator Hugo Chavez, a good friend of the American left. A good friend of the American left. Chavez, a good son of New York, who went down there to falsify the election for him. You want me to give you names? Good friends of Jimmy Carter. Proud American liberals who went down there to falsify this election for Hugo Chavez. And after he won, he threw Jews out of his country. Have they ever apologized? No, because most of them are drugged up out of their minds. Most of them are on drugs. Do you know that? Do you know how many of your leaders are on psychopharmaceuticals and don't even know what they're doing? You'd be shocked to find out. You have to take a drug test to get a job, don't you? Why doesn't your senator or your congressman have to submit to a drug test in order to keep his job? Tell me why. Does that explain somewhat why we're living in the twilight zone that I'm describing to you today? So in South America, you have Chavez closing down the opposition media in Venezuela. And you say, well, that can't happen here. It is happening here. Senator Tom Harkin, Senator Jeff Bingaman, Senator Richard Durbin, Nancy Pelosi, Dianne Feinstein, they all want the fairness doctrine. They all want it. They all want it. What do we threaten them with? Freedom of speech. Freedom of speech? I thought that was a God-given right in our U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights. Is that right? Well, you're losing it, you idiots. Do you understand that you're losing it? Do you have any idea what's going to happen to you if you don't stand up to them? Just as I'm standing up to them, you're going to stand up to them. Now, a lot of what I just said to you just now in the last few minutes, many of you were stirred by it, is a preview of the address that I'm going to deliver to the Cambridge Union on October 15, 2009. I just gave you a preview. And I want to summarize it in one or two lines. I did not choose this fight. The fate of more than a man hangs in the balance. I decided yesterday, when I took the day off, to include this speech in my book, Banned in Britain. And it's going to be there for all to see. And now I'm going to take a short breather on the Savage Nation by taking your calls right here on the program. Again, you can go to the website, michaelsavage.com, and check out all these incredible stories. There's a wonderful couple of stories up there, which I'll summarize a little later on. But we have to remember one major thing, is that we're living in the twilight zone in this country today. We're no longer a nation that wins. We're in a nation that doesn't even lose. We're in a twilight zone. We are distracted by sports, by entertainment, by pornography, and by drugs, and by alcohol. We are a nation that is distracted by everything but the truth. And that is why we have distracted leaders leading us into the abyss and over the abyss, over the abyss, over the abyss, over the abyss. And I say it's time that we get a leader who says to Iran, for example, my friend, either you stop your nuclear weapons program or we're going to unleash a firestorm on your nation like you've never seen before. You will bring a nightmare upon your people like you've never seen before. Stop threatening us. Do the right thing. You can't have nuclear weapons because you're threatening to wipe a nation off the map. That's the difference between a nation that can have nuclear weapons and a nation that must never be permitted to have nuclear weapons. And I'm going to tell you that I found an article over the weekend that I hope is true. I don't know whether it is propaganda or there is any truth to it. But the article is the lead article on my website, michaelsavage.com. It says, U.S. giant bunker buster bomb project rushed since Iran's Qum site discovered. And the Pentagon, they say, has brought forward to December of 2009, that's only a few months from now, the target date to produce the first 15-ton super bunker buster bomb. Massive Ordnance Penetrator, MOP. Do you know what this bomb could do? It can burrow into the ground 60 meters down under the ground. That's about 185 feet before it explodes. And why are they doing it? I don't know, but the article says that Air Force units are working around the clock to adapt the bay of a B-2A stealth bomber to carry and deliver this bomb. And I can guarantee you this bomb is not going to be delivered to Ireland. I can guarantee you that this B-2A bomber is not going to appear out of nowhere without any warning over France. I can guarantee you that the Pentagon has ordered the number of bombs rolling off the production line increased from 4 to 10 to show you how difficult it is to build them. They can only build 10 of them. 10 of them. 10 of them. And did you know that Congress has since inserted the necessary funding for these bombs in the 2009 budget? Well, that means that maybe behind the scenes there is some steel. Maybe there is some hope. Maybe they understand that negotiations have failed and that we're dealing with a maniac, an apocalyptic maniac by the name of Ahmadinejad, who wants to bring about the apocalypse because he believes then the ultimate imam will enter the world and the world will become Muslim if he brings about the apocalypse. He cannot have nuclear weapons. Maybe there are sober heads who are not drugged out of their minds somewhere in the leadership. I don't know. I never hear from them. But maybe they're there. And we read in the article that the schedule of building these bunker buster bombs and adapting the bay of the B-2A stealth bombers to carry and deliver the bombs are being done by the U.S. Air Force. Once again, perhaps this is true. We learned that the Air Force Research Laboratory at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and the Munitions Directorate and Air Armament Center, both headquartered at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida, are finally doing the people's work. That's right. And so we have 10 to 12 giant bunker buster bombs being built in order to counter Iranian and North Korean underground nuclear plants. The only question is, do we have the leadership to use it? Or will we remain in the twilight zone of America until one day we wake up and it is 62,000 degrees and we have a permanent twilight over our cities? I'll be right back. So here we have genuine threats from insane apocalyptic individuals in the world threatening a nuclear annihilation and building towards it, building rockets and building nuclear weapons. And here in San Francisco, the crazies go to a so-called Folsom Street Fair. They wrap each other in leather and bondage outfits. They beat each other in the streets with whips while naked. They perform sex acts in the street on floats. And Nancy Pelosi last year called the Folsom Street Parade a wholesome affair. That's the Italian grandmother who was presiding over our Congress. She calls this kind of behavior a wholesome affair. And that's where we the people find ourselves. That's where we the people find ourselves. 'Tis the majority. In this, as all prevail, assent, and you are sane. Demure, you're straightaway dangerous and handled with a chain. So said Emily Dickinson, who lived between 1830 and 1886. 'Tis the majority, in this as all prevail. Assent, and you are sane. Demure, you're straightaway dangerous and handled with a chain. In other words, I'm supposed to say the Folsom Street Fair is wholesome and healthful and good for children. I'm supposed to assent to this insanity, just as I'm supposed to assent to Obama's insanity of soft diplomacy, which has failed miserably. It has failed wherever he has tried it. They're laughing at him around the world. And here we are living in a twilight zone, waiting for somebody to come along and save us. New York City, WOR. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Oh, hello. Dr. Savage?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, hi. I have a quote for you. It's regarding your fight to clear your name in Britain.
I'd love to hear.
It's from Henry V. And you probably know it already, but I thought I would still...
No, I don't carry it around. I can read it if I find it, but please go ahead.
Okay. It's, we would not seek a battle as we are, nor as we are, we say we will not shun it.
Well, there's many different ways to put it. The Bible speaks about it. I was in a Jewish religious service the other day, and the rabbi gave a speech that was amazing. He said that ordinary men are sometimes called to do extraordinary things without even knowing they've been called, and either they're chosen for that fight and they have to come up to it, or they just fail. Their whole life is a failure, but their whole life can be defined by that battle, Elizabeth.
True.
So again, I would rather have not had this happen to me.
Right.
So that's the end of the story. I'm not here to complain. I haven't lost yet. You understand, Elizabeth?
Right. I mean,
they've tried to shame me. They've tried to destroy my name and reputation, but they haven't won yet. And at the end, remember what happened. The Home Secretary who did this on behalf of the pillhead Gordon Brown, the Home Secretary herself, got fired soon thereafter because she was no longer an asset to that administration. She became a liability, and so they threw her overboard. I thank you very much for those kind words. Again, I don't want to harp on me. People will get bored, and they'll say, I've heard it all. I don't want to hear it anymore. But look, this is my battle. This is my fight. This is going to be the defining battle of my life, and I'm going to be remembered by this more than anything else I have ever written or done. That's absolutely the truth. Think about that. I've written 25 books. I've traveled a good part of the world collecting medicinal plants. I've done some good things along the way, and no evil, incidentally, despite the lies put out by the vermin in the media. And the fact of the matter is, this will be my defining moment, the savage fight against censorship. And as I was finishing the book last night, it's going to the printer tomorrow, the first edition, first printing, that's it. That's it. You get on the line today or tomorrow, or you're going to get the first printing, second edition. Remember, I did this with last year with the psychological nudity? I wasn't lying to you, was I? I can't reprint first edition, first printing. I can make the first first edition, second printing next time. So you say, well, what does that matter to me? Well, you want a collector's edition. That's what matters. But it's not just about me at all. It's about you. It's about you. To wake up and realize that you, to your own amazement, have been condemned by a government without any forewarning? What would you do if you woke up and your government put you on a list with murderers here in America and they hadn't given you a chance to defend yourself in court? They didn't say, did you actually say this, John? Did you actually say any of these things, John? What do you say to these charges? Don't we live in a nation of due process? Don't we live in a world of due process? Isn't Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, doesn't she have the obligation to defend an American citizen who is unfairly attacked by enemies of America, whether they be declared enemies or otherwise? Yes, but she has failed me. She has failed me because she is not a Secretary of State. She is a secretary of the Democratic state of Obama.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
This isn't a football game, so I'm not interested in victory. I'm interested in resolving. The problem is that Iran repeatedly says that it's pursuing nuclear energy only for peaceful purposes, and its actions contradict its words.
We're in trouble, ladies and gentlemen. We have a man completely out of his league, a man who is frightened at the responsibility that has befallen him. But I didn't ask for it. He did. He wanted to be president, and now he's faced with North Korea spitting in his face, Russia spitting in his face, Iran spitting in his face, Venezuela spitting in his face. Can you name one nation that has said yes, yes, we can to Barack Obama? Well, all of them have said yes, we can, not yes, you can. Yeah, every nation said yes, we can. Not yes, you can. Every nation has said America is garbage. Every nation has answered his pleas with derision. And so here we are, sitting here and waiting. And as I say to you, we're waiting in a twilight zone. We're once a nation that liked to win, that took pride in our winning. We strove to be a winner nation. And now for 30 or so years, the liberals have brainwashed America, saying that victory and winning were wrong. They said that victory held shame. That's why Obama just said, I'm not looking to be victorious here. Did you hear what the president said? Did you hear what the commander-in-chief said? Did you hear what he said? Play the top of that again so they hear clearly what he just said.
Yeah, this isn't a football game. So I'm not interested in victory. I'm interested in
resolving. Stop right there. I'm not interested in victory. This is liberal pep. This is the liberal platitude. I am not interested in victory that Obama was brainwashed with since youth. First of all, it's a lie. He certainly was interested in the victory of becoming the president. He's certainly interested in the victory of bringing socialized medicine to a free market economy. He is certainly interested in the victory of destroying General Motors and turning it into Government Motors. He has certainly been interested in the victory of turning the banks into arms of the United States government. So I don't believe a word he says when he says he's not interested in victory. He is very much interested in victory when it comes to domestic dictatorship. But apparently he's not interested in victory when it comes to international victories. No. Now they just simply want self-esteem to rage throughout the world. So we've entered the twilight zone of American power. We don't know whether we won or lost in Iraq to this day. We don't know whether we're winning or losing in Afghanistan. We don't know whether we want victory or defeat against Iran. Why? I don't know why. I know what we need in order to defend ourselves, in order to have some semblance of safety and security and freedom. We have to have victory. Just as in a boxing ring, there are very, very few draws in the boxing ring. That's why people love to watch boxing matches or football games or baseball games or basketball games. Most people don't go there to see a tie score 100 to 100. Tell me the last time you went to a ball game and wanted to see a score of 4 to 4. You didn't want to see that. Do you go to a boxing match to watch the match end in a draw? You go there to see a knockout. You want to see a clear winner and a clear loser. That's what you want to see. That's in the human spirit. The human spirit is a spirit that wants to win. It does not want to lose. And our enemies know that. And our enemies smell weakness, and so they sense that now is their time to win. And they don't understand that the American people will not let them win. They don't understand the American people because the vermin in the media hide us from the international enemies of freedom. Do you know that they've hidden the town hall meetings from your friends in France, Germany, Saudi Arabia, and Iran? Do you know that they've not even seen you over there? Because the vermin in the media want the world to see a distinguished man called Obama, the new chairman of the world, Chairman Barack Hussein Obama. That's the image they want to project, a man totally in charge of his country. When have they seen you speak? When have they heard me speak? Well, apparently in England they heard me speak. I don't know how. Apparently the show's not heard there, but I'm so dangerous that I can't even go to England. But let's forget me for the moment. Let's go back to America, the twilight zone of American culture today. That's the problem today. And here in America, we're supposed to have unity when we have the greatest disunity in modern American history. I've never seen such disunity and such agitation between not only the parties, but the races in this country. Apparently Obama has set off a minor schism amongst people who had learned to get along. He has made people or taught people not to trust each other. He has taught Democrat to fear Republican. He has taught through Nancy Pelosi's paranoia that anyone who opposes socialized medicine is a Nazi or a thug or about to commit violence. We have a Democrat leadership that is literally psychotically paranoid to the extent that they fear the people of America. They don't even accept that you have an argument. They don't even accept that they may be wrong. They don't even accept that there isn't any money to pay for these grand socialist schemes. All they say is that you are a Nazi or you are a stormtrooper if you say, wait a minute, we can't afford to pay for socialized medicine. We can't afford to pay cap and trade. We can't afford to go along this primrose path of these grand social visions that are talked about in universities around America and discussed amongst pinheads and ivory tower morons who have never worked a day in their life, people who have never met a payroll, people who don't know what it's like to sacrifice for a business, take a chance, to make an investment and hope that it pays off, and to sometimes lose and get up and try again. They don't know any of that in the universities. All they know is that the money keeps flowing in through the government. And so they feel that they now have unlimited money to put forward these programs. And so that if anybody opposes them, they call you names. The sober people amongst us who are business people, ordinary people like you and I, who have to meet payrolls, who have to get up in the morning and earn a living, say, wait a minute, you idiots, you can't afford to pay for these things. And what do? The paranoid Nancy Pelosi calls you Nazi. The paranoid Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer and Dick Durbin, all of the rest of that constellation of fools calls you names. Instead of actually hearing you, they attack you. Instead of listening to the people of America who actually have to pay the bill, they condemn you. They turn you into something you're not. They come up with statements such as, health care is a universal right. Health care is a universal right. Well, I would say that it's a universal right for me to keep what I earn. Is it not a universal right for me to go to make a living, work very hard, and keep what I earn? The government says, no, I'll take 60% of what you earn through federal, state, local, FICA, you name it. I will take it. I will seize it. Hail Caesar. Hail Harry Reid. I will take what you earn. You have no right to keep what you earn. I have a right to take what you earn and give it to those who don't work, or give it to those who are here illegally, or give it to those who are less fortunate than you. No, that's my decision whether I want to give it to those less fortunate than me. It is not the government's right to take it from me. That's what the people said at the town hall meetings, in more words than one. And how were they met? Nancy Pelosi, the paranoid maniac, says you are a Nazi for speaking out against universal health care, the public option where everyone entering this country legally, illegally, does not matter, double dipping, triple dipping, quadruple dipping, does not matter, free ambulance rides for all. How will we pay for it, Madam Speaker? I don't know. I don't care. Get out of my way. I am the Speaker of the House. I am the first woman Speaker of the House. Sense means nothing to me. Power means all. You get it? You understand what's going on in this country? I do. Now let's go to the callers. Let's go to Florida. Jeff, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please. What's on your mind?
It's something extremely important for us French. I don't speak for all the French. I'm going to speak for me and my family and my friends who are here and back in France. Since the last past 10 years, we are listening to you. And we wish that, seriously, we will have a kind of a speaker that will speak for all the French people who think like you. And
Well, what happened to Sarkozy? When Sarkozy was interior minister, he acted tough against the Muslim gangs in the northern Parisian suburbs who were burning cars. I mean, let's clear the air. Isn't that how Sarkozy came to power? Because he stood up to the Muslim thugs who were burning cars? Isn't that fundamentally what happened?
Yes, absolutely.
That's exactly right. I know reality. And what happened once he became president of France? The skirt chaser went around the world chasing more skirts.
Absolutely. And the fact is that Sarkozy is extremely strong when he decided, when he had his strategy, and his objective was to come in power like Obama. But I will compare him more than anybody else to Mitterrand when he did came to the power in 81. I was 20 in 81, and I voted for Mitterrand because I was expecting the change. And this change arrived for 14 years. He put France in the mess for 14 years. So I understand.
Well, I want to say this, and I don't mean to cut you off, Jeff. You say you've been listening to this show for 10 years in Florida, and you wish that there was someone who could articulate like I articulate for your people in France, and I agree with you 1,000%. Jeff, let me do this for you. I'm going to send you one of the rare first edition, first printing copies of Banned in Britain that will be out mid-October. I'm rushing to get them printed tomorrow, meaning I'm going to send in the money tomorrow for the first edition, first printing, and then the door slams shut. And I have to get them ready for the conference that's coming up at the end of October in Washington, D.C. It's a great First Amendment conference where many important First Amendment principal individuals will be, and I've been invited to give the keynote address, and God willing, I plan on being there, and I hope it'll be as good as the expectations. But let's go back to the news of the day. There's plenty of news of the day, and I guess the best place for me to go is not to talk about Dan Rather or a powerful quake off Samoa. I mean, those things are important, I guess, to Dan Rather and to people living in Samoa, but they're not that important to me. Dan Rather is a has-been and a washout. And he has been a has-been in a washout for a long time. And I'm glad that his case was thrown out because he had no case. On my website, you see a few articles that are very important to look at. Real Hope U.S. Accelerates Monster Bunker Busting Bombs Project. Let's hope it's a true story. The Savage petition to defend free speech is up there. Costs you nothing. We're at about, what, 38,000, Godric? 40,000? Close to 40,000 people. And then go down the list. Senate panel rejects public option. In a decisive vote that could forecast the demise of a proposed government health insurance plan, the Senate Finance Committee voted against creating a public option. Hey, that's amazing. Oklahoma City bomb tapes appear to be edited. I don't know if you saw that story. That's a mind blower. Did you read that story? It came out of the Associated Press, not covered by the midstream media. But the secret security tapes showing the chaos immediately after the 1995 bombing of the Oklahoma City federal buildings are blank in the few minutes before the blast on all the cameras around the building. This came out as a result of a Freedom of Information lawsuit filed by a man who lost his brother in it. And it's very suspicious that all four security cameras would have gone blank 4 minutes prior to the bombing of the Oklahoma City federal building. Now, as you well know, Hitler had his Reichstag fire. Some think the Oklahoma City bombing was a government conspiracy to prop up Bill Clinton during the dark days of Monica Lewinsky. I am not a conspiracist, so I don't believe that. I believe something else is being covered up. Empire State Building celebrates communism. New York's iconic Empire State Building will light up red and yellow tomorrow in honor of the 60th anniversary of communist China. That's amazing. Northeast, all you global warming libs up there in New York and Vermont, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New Hampshire. Attention, fools of the liberal persuasion. The Northeast may have the coldest winter in a decade because of a weak El Nino, a warming current in the Pacific Ocean. And yet you still believe in the myth of man-induced global warming. Get out your muckalucks. You're going to need them. Let's take a break.
Savage.
I know I'd go from rags to riches if you would only say you care. And though my pocket may be
from rags to riches. Frankie Lane, is that who it is? Yeah.
I'd be a millionaire.
Tony Bennett, sorry. Tony Bennett. Eh, I don't like it. I don't like it at all. How about another song? Give me one of the other ones from Goodfellas. I got to admit, I watched it on TV, a replay. I can't. Some of those movies by Scorsese are so gripping because they're so full of garbage and such crap that you can't stop watching them. There's absolutely no relationship between what he projects in the movie and the reality of that world, so far as I can tell from people I've met who know the real. It's fiction. Total fiction. Everyone's sitting around with the sausage, and they all love each other in the backyards of Jackson Heights. They all loved each other. All one unity. Stabbed each other in the back as often as possible. There was no, what did they say amongst thieves? Something amongst thieves. Honor amongst thieves. When did that end, honor amongst thieves? About when honor amongst politicians ended. And honor amongst the talk show hosts. What about Polanski? What about Polanski with the 13-year-old? You know, there's a few things I have to say about this that are not being said. I watched the fraud show, Porn Vanity, the other day. And Porn Vanity, of course, took the normal position you'd expect from a knee-jerk, flag-wrapped Republican front man, and right away said he's a pervert and a child molester and he should be brought back and basically quartered and over the coals. And everyone assented with Porn Vanity. Yeah, that's an easy one, sure, Porn. But, you know, I thought about it, and certainly I'm not going soft on a child case like this, but do you know that the mother was basically pimping out her daughter? I read the transcripts going back a long time. The mother took the child to have sex with Polanski for money, number one. He didn't know how old she was, number two. The mother should be arrested, but she's dead. You want to talk about the whole case? Let's do it.
Savage.
Can't we be sweethearts? Why don't we fall in love right from the start? You're the girl I'm thinking of. Oh, can't you see?
It is the Savage Nation. I want to talk about the Polanski case for a couple of reasons. Here is a man who not only confessed the statutory rape of a 13-year-old girl, but then fled the country prior to sentencing. Now, there's a few things that need to be said. Some of them are conflicting, I admit. That's because I'm still thinking about this case in all of its depth. Number one, you got to hand it to the film industry. At least they rally around their own. At least they come to the defense of one of their own, unlike talk radio, which has absolutely no such loyalties. Now, it is true that he confessed to statutory rape, but you need to see the whole case. First of all, he's not the only Hollywood celebrity to be accused of child abuse. Woody Allen and Michael Jackson are certainly coming to mind. I'm sure if you spent a little time on it, you'd find that this is more common than you might think. And entertainment in America is the new religion. Make no mistake about it, the entertainment industry is the new church. Sex, violence, and money are the new trinity in the United States of America. And entertainment is the new opiate of the masses. And we don't want our supply of such entertainment opium disturbed by anyone, which is why a supplier of this opiate, one of the suppliers of this opiate, a sort of, you would call him an entertainment supplier, an entertainment dealer or creator, Polanski, is protected by his own. Now, why is there no outcry? Why is there no outcry about this? Let's go to the church situation. What if the Knights of Columbus decided to give an award to a pedophile priest who had fled the country to avoid prison, asks Father Tom Rees? He says the outcry would be universal, right? Victim groups would demand that the award be withdrawn, and the organization would be forced to apologize. So-called reporters of religion would get harumphing in the newspapers, and editorial writers and columnists would denounce the Knights of Columbus as another example of the insensitivity of the Catholic Church to sexual abuse. And they would be right, he writes. And he would join them, he says. So why, then, is there no such outcry with regard to Polanski? Well, there's a few reasons. First of all, they say Polanski never set himself up as a moral guide. Oh, okay, so that's an excuse? He admitted guilt early. That's certainly not an excuse. He did flee. Now, from the point of view of law, he does have to come back and face trial. If the original accusations against Polanski and his arrest are retried and he is found to be innocent, then he will walk. If he's innocent as he says he is, if he says the judge was reneging on his promise of a plea bargain, well, then perhaps he should come back and face the music. But it's quite relevant to the issue, the germane issue, that he must come back, incidentally, and face a trial here in Los Angeles, and I'll tell you why. There's another famous case of the killer of a girlfriend in Philadelphia many, many decades ago. He was the man, by the way, Ira Einhorn is his name, who created Earth Day, a big, fat, blubbery, loudmouth, fraudulent, phony, communist vermin protected by Arlen Specter, while Arlen Specter was a district attorney in Philadelphia. Arlen Specter was then a Democrat. He's now a Democrat as well. He's always been a turncoat. I've called him a turncoat for years. I told you he would do this eventually. Anyway, Arlen Specter was the classic double-talking, compromising, two-faced phony that we have come to expect in politics. And Arlen Specter helped get this murderer, Ira Einhorn, out of Philadelphia. Now, Einhorn hid for 25 or so years in Sweden and France with his Swedish girlfriend. And with a little help from his liberal friends, he avoided extradition back to the United States for a very, very long time. In fact, it was heard by the French Supreme Court several times. Once they said, no, we don't have to, it doesn't have to go back. But eventually Einhorn had to come back. And it was all due to the efforts of only one woman. And that was a dogged district attorney in Philadelphia who said she would spend her every minute getting that man back to trial. He came back, was found guilty, and he's now in jail in America, facing a life sentence. But he did come back. He was extradited. I believe Polanski has to be brought back, and he has to face trial. Now, having said all of that, I believe that there are circumstances that need to be discussed here as well. First of all, this alleged rape occurred in Jack Nicholson's house. By today's laws, is Jack Nicholson culpable for the offense? I don't know. Should Jack Nicholson have to face trial for some offense? Maybe that's the reason the entertainment industry is going berserk. He is a gigantic money earner for the mafia in Hollywood, excuse me, for the entertainment industry. And the mafia in Hollywood, the entertainment industry, certainly doesn't want to lose a prize director and a prize actor. So they don't want them in court. It's bad for business. So that's why they're lobbying to make sure that he never comes back to face punishment. Now, if Roman Polanski were a Republican, this case would already be closed. He'd be already on a plane. That's number one. But let's look at some of the other issues here. By what I read going back when this first occurred, and I'm not justifying what he did, the mother was the type in Hollywood that brought her daughter around for sex, for money and exposure in the movies. You go back to the 1930s, and there are stories of, I think, one of the major Hollywood moguls who constantly had mothers bringing young girls, even younger than her, so that this old, disgusting pervert could have his way with them. I know the man's name. I don't want to say it right now because I have enough lawsuit problems to deal with. I think you can know who it is. In fact, he was portrayed in The Godfather when he comes out of a room in the mansion with a little girl. Do you remember that? And the mother takes her away. It was almost a duplicate of the Polanski. So the mother brought the girl around. Now, I read the transcript on Smoking Gun the other day of the original prosecution in the court. And he asks this 13-year-old girl, did you ever have sex before? Yes. Did you have blank sex before? Yes. That's how I know what it was. Did you ever see a quaalude before? Yes. Did you ever use a quaalude before? Yes. So this was used by her mother to gain money and probably entree into these circles and also into possibly the movie world. I don't know. That's number one. Now, do these excuse the behavior? Do these circumstances excuse his behavior? Not by today's law. I don't think by any law can he be excused for having sex with a 13-year-old girl, particularly when he drugged her with quaaludes and alcohol, allegedly, in Jack Nicholson's house. Jack Nicholson's house. Jack Nicholson's house. Jack Nicholson's house. Jack. Nicholson's house. Now, of course, we're not saying Jack Nicholson had anything to do with this. He wasn't there. But it was Jack Nicholson's house. And we don't know by today's laws whether that would be any kind of issue for the owner of the house. I do know that if you rent your house out or lend it out to a friend and they sell drugs in it, you lose your house, don't you? Today, if you have guests over and they deal drugs and the DEA breaks in and seizes the drugs, do you lose your house? I really don't know. So there are many, many tentacles to this case. So the defense of Polanski is an interesting one. He has to defend himself. And he has to come back and face the music here in order to deal with this. And we know that he transgressed once. We don't know if he transgressed more than once. And there's no evidence that he did so. But this is Hollywood. And he is an entertainment dealer, the same way the drug lords would defend the drug dealer in court with the most expensive shysters the money could buy. The entertainment dealer will be defended by the best shysters that money could buy. My guess is that the entertainment shysters will grease the palms all the way up and down, and that Polanski will never come back and face trial, and it will soon be forgotten. That's my guess. You want to talk about that or not? Phone number 1-800-449-8255. Not a big story. I mean, you could argue that Polanski did set himself up as a moral guide. They say he's not a priest and therefore he shouldn't be judged as a hypocrite. Some of his movies did have a moral message. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest supposedly had a moral message. I remember seeing the first big movie of his, A Knife in the Water, which I actually loved, incidentally. I mean, he's a fabulously talented director. But that does not take away the fact that he drugged the girl, raped the girl, sodomized the girl. Now, he says he didn't know she was underage, right? Well, I don't know. She herself says she wants the case to go away. Why does the victim, who is now a grown woman, want the case to go away? Huh? Well, because it's not so much that she forgives Polanski, but because she's going to have to come to court and relive the events again and talk about the sodomy, talk about the drugs, talk about the rape. Okay. So there it is. I mean, I don't know what you could say about this. He gave a 13-year-old girl Quaaludes and alcohol. Then he raped her. Then he pled guilty. And then he fled the country. He's not accused. He's not accused. He was convicted. He raped a child. He's then a bail-jumping director. So you say, is it fair to arrest a man at age 76 after 32 years in exile, meaning on the run? He's on the run. And he made a good living all these years, married and fathered two children. He won an Oscar. But he could never come back to America to enjoy the pasta palaces of Los Angeles. Gave a 13-year-old girl Quaalude and champagne, then he raped her. Then he sodomized her. Did she look older than 13 years? I don't know. I wasn't there. Does she now say she'd rather not see him prosecuted because she can't stand the media attention? Yes. But the fact of the matter is this a really a rape? Of course it's a rape. I don't mean he jumped out of a bush and grabbed her and pulled her in and raped her, but it's still rape. By today's law, it was more of a crime today than it was then. Whoopi Goldberg, of course, being the morally compromised creature that she is, says it was not a rape. That's the moral paradigm of Whoopi Goldberg, the genius, Whoopi Goldberg. Whoopi Cushion Goldberg says, oh, it wasn't really a rape. Oh, no, really was a rape, actually. It was a rape, Whoopi, but you wouldn't know it because you live in the polluted sewers of Hollywood. You swim in the cesspool of Hollywood. You swim in the sewer pipe that Hollywood pumps out to the entire world. The sewer pipe of Hollywood unleashes its effluence upon the world, Whoopi, and you're part of the effluence. So certainly you wouldn't know whether it was rape or rape. Do you want to talk about that or the Twilight Zone of American culture? Any topic is fair game. Maine, Paul, go. You're on the Savage Nation.
Michael, it's good to talk to you again. I used to listen to you when I lived in San Francisco. I'm wondering about why it took so long to suddenly, quote, catch, end quote, Roman Polanski now when they've known he's had a residence in Switzerland for 20 years. You know, is this to make a policy?
It's interesting. In other words, why did Switzerland pull the trigger on him now? I don't know. Why now?
I'm wondering if it's just another diversionary tactic from the media.
I doubt it. What I think it is he has some enemy in Hollywood who was blackmailing him on something and said, "Let pay up, or you know, we're going to have the Swiss authorities take you in."
Huh.
I'm guessing. By the way, how did you get to Maine from San Francisco? They're like polar opposites, aren't they?
They are. At one point, I lived on an island off the coast. My wife was born here, and we didn't want to raise our kids in San Francisco, so we came back.
Oh, well, raising a child in San Francisco? Are you kidding me? Hey, Paul, I once spent a few weeks when I was very young at a place called Tennant's Harbor, Maine, one of the most serene places on earth. Those islands off the coast of Maine are astounding.
Yeah, we lived in Peaks Island for a long time.
I don't think I could do it today, honest to God. I would go crazy. I mean, I love the idea of it in movies, how nice it looks, the grassy slopes down to the bay and all. I lived in Marblehead, Massachusetts. I love the ferocious ocean in the winters. But I tell you the truth, at this point in my life, I don't think I could ever, you can't go home again. But if I had young children, absolutely the best thing in the world. Take them away from the cesspools. Chicago, Mike, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I'd like to say that I read into this case a few years ago, and Roman Polanski knew that this girl was only 13 years old because she was a model, and she was well known as being a young model that was a young girl. So he knew all about that.
So, in other words, he chose her, he asked for her to come to the house because she was young?
Yes, exactly. Yep, you're right.
And of course, if he were a priest, what do you think would happen? You think he would have been able to live with impunity in France all these years and practice in a church?
Well, here's the thing. I have relatives who are Holocaust survivors, too, but I don't care. If they did that, I would want them to go to prison, too. So
Interesting thing. Yeah, I've heard that Hearts and Flowers, that he suffered enough. Well, I don't think that the family suffering and his suffering gives him the right to inflict this kind of emotional damage upon a child. And I believe the people need justice in this world. I don't know whether the Obama Justice Department, the same Eric Holder, the attorney general, who after all gave a pardon to Mark Rich, after all gave a pardon to six Puerto Rican terrorists, and after all is pursuing the heroes of the CIA, I doubt very much that Eric Holder has the moral compass to do the right thing with regard to Roman Polanski. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Boom, boom, boom.
So we're talking about a number of things. One of them is Roland Polanski. The man pled guilty to a felony sex crime that has no statute of limitations, number one. And then he avoided added flight to avoid incarceration. I mean, he broke the law. So if you believe that a society should be ruled by law and justice, he has to be detained and he has to come back to Los Angeles and make his arguments in court, not on TV and in newspapers. But having said that, you know, there's a new phrase going on for a while now. 60 is the new 40, meaning that if you're 60, you normally you look 40. You know what I mean? Like if you're 60, you look like your father did at 40. But today in Hollywood, amongst girls, 13 is the new 30. You could say the same thing if you wanted. But it doesn't excuse it. I mean, years ago, there used to be a funny phrase that guys said before my time, a night with Venus and a lifetime with Mercury. What does that mean? It was funny. People were literate. They were more literate then than now after all these years in college, which are nothing but institutions of lower learning, except in the hard sciences or in mathematics or in physics. They're basically just basically houses of ill repute. Men were literate. They read the classics. So they would make jokes. A night with Venus, a lifetime with Mercury. What does that mean? That a man had sex with someone at night, and maybe he got syphilis. And in those days, pre-World War II, the treatment for syphilis was the toxic heavy metal mercury. Of course, the mercury poisoning killed you faster than the syphilis did. But so that was the joke, a night with Venus, a lifetime with mercury. But let's look at the case itself. What do you think is actually going on here? I think it's possible that there could already be a deal in place to extradite him, and that a Los Angeles judge, which is an oxymoron, will resentence Polanski after a long, heartfelt trial about being the child of Holocaust victims, the fact that he lost his wife to Charles Manson in the most horrendous way, by the way, and his great contribution to culture. And then the ratings will go through the ceiling, and whatever movie he's about to release will do five times the gross that it would have done before. So the result is that it could be a business deal. That's what I think it could be. And I think that's what it's all about. Frankly, I think that if he did a movie that was based upon his sex act with this girl, it would surpass the gross of Lolita. He could actually play himself. He could play the girl's father. Oh, there was no father. That's right. He could play the girl's mother in drag. Florida Ryan, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Dr. Savage. I just wanted to comment about this girl was given an undisclosed amount of money. I think that's why she doesn't want to see the case come to trial. And the law is the law. It's black and white.
It is black and white. Absolutely. There's no statute of limitations on this kind of crime. You know that.
Absolutely, because they're going to let them get away with this. What else are they going to get away with? They're going to just allow
I don't know. No, the American people, frankly, all family people want this guy to face trial. But I wouldn't expect real justice. I think that he's already got a deal worked out. Because you have to ask yourself, why all of a sudden did this come up? Why? I mean, something's in the works here. I think it was engineered, set up in advance, and I believe they're going to guarantee Polanski's return to France, the great cesspool of Europe. Remember, France is the country that housed that vermin, Ira Einhorn, who I just told you about. So, France.
Liberté, equalité, fraternité.
Poor France has been nothing since Napoleon. Well, that's it for the second hour of the Savage Nation. Stay tuned for another large, big hour. Coming up in the next hour, we have many, many surprises for you here on the Savage Nation. Be here or be nowhere.
Savage. Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Well, the news is the continuous decline and fall of Western civilization with the ascendancy of a thousand years of darkness with the Marx Brothers running the West. Welcome to the Savage Nation. Marx Brothers being Obama, Sarkozy, and, well, you name it, Brown of England, Merkel of Germany. Do you see anybody with a spine? I don't. You got Iran saying you'll regret it every day, building another, taking another step towards a missile that can reach anywhere in Europe or the Middle East, and we do nothing. The military-industrial complex rapes us for millions and millions of dollars a day, and when it comes time to use the weapons, nobody's home. They're out doing photo ops looking to get a job with a contractor when they leave the military. And who's on the front lines? America's bravest, taking a bullet for the superb contractors in uniform. Well, I finished my book. It's going to the printer today. And what I did was, is I put the address that I'm going to deliver to the Cambridge Union on October 15th into the book. I decided to include it in the book. And, you know, there's one line in here that I feel obligated to read to my audience right now. And I added this because of a spiritual satori that I had on Monday. And here it is. I have been chosen for a battle I did not choose to fight. The fate of more than a man hangs in the balance. Well, what do I mean by that? I didn't choose to be banned in Britain. I didn't choose to be the only member of the American media to be banned from Western democracy for something I didn't do. And what do I mean by the statement, the fate of more than a man hangs in the balance? Pretty simple. What it means is, if I am allowed to hang out there and dry and twist in the wind by my so-called fellow conservatives in the media, they will be next, and after them, you will be next. That's why I wrote Banned in Britain, The Savage Fight Against Censorship. And I think it's going to be a very important book, The Savage Fight Against Censorship. Have Borders, Language, and Culture Become Illegal? My letter to Hillary Clinton, of course, that was never answered.
And while you were fighting for your freedom, Gordon Brown in England, was he fighting against the dangers to his country? No, he was promising to crack down on bad parents. That's what he was up to in the last couple of days.
Bad parents?
Bad parents, that's right.
Oh, so he's going to become the super daddy? This pill-taking fop is going to become the super daddy? The pill-taking fop is going to be super daddy of England. Fop? I noticed that the institutions of lower living, which have become nothing but cat houses, meaning universities, has gotten so bad, sex in the dorms, that one of these slumlords in Massachusetts, I forget the name of it, whatever it was called. I mean, you say college today. Oh, Tufts University. When I was a kid, that was a university. You know what it is today? A house of ill repute. It may as well be on HBO. They should put handy cams in the dorms of Tufts. The sex is so rampant that they had to put out a memo saying you may not engage in sexual activity while your roommate is present in the room, says Tufts guest policy. That's because of the raunchy romps going on in the dormitories, you hear? That's where they go there to learn. I mean, there's nothing new about teenagers and young adults having sex. But college used to be a place to sort of put, you know, sex aside, repress your emotions, and learn something that might be useful when you got out, other than texting and learning how to order a double mocha latte. Let's see what else. There was some positive news that I saw out of a Middle Eastern website last night. I don't know whether it's true or false. I mean, I got excited by it because it looked like there was hope. And they said that U.S. giant bunker buster bomb project rushed since Iran's Qum site discovered. Now, I don't know whether it's true or it's just false, but it says the Pentagon has brought forward to December of 2009 the target date for producing the first 15-ton super bunker buster bombs, massive ordnance penetrator, which can reach a depth of 60 meters underground, 180 feet before exploding. So it's dropped from a plane or fired by a rocket, I think an airplane, a B-2. It travels 180 feet into the ground, then it explodes, obviously to take out Iran's nuclear facilities on the ground. But more to the story said that top U.S. Defense Air Force agencies are working against the clock to adapt the bay of a B-2A stealth bomber for carrying and delivering the bomb. I mean, if we were to believe this, I would say we're getting our money's worth, don't you? It says the Pentagon has ordered the number of bombs rolling off the production line increased from 4 to 10. You hear this? Only 10. A rush job triggered in May by the discovery that Iran was hiding a second uranium enrichment plant under a mountain near Qom. Congress has since quietly inserted the necessary funding in the 09 budget. All this urgency indicates that the Obama administration has been preparing military muscle to back up the international condemnation of Iran's concealed nuclear bomb program. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know whether it's wishful thinking or what. It says, according to their military sources, the earliest date for the accelerated Pentagon program to produce a super bunker buster bomb mounted on a stealth bomber is December 09 or January 10. This is 3 years ahead of its original schedule. Pressed into service are two U.S. Air Force research centers for work on adapting the radar-evading stealth bomber to the giant bomb. The Air Force Research Laboratory at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and the Munitions Directorate and Air Armament Center, both headquartered at Eglin Air Force Base in Florida. You mean they're actually doing something other than studying affirmative action bulletins and EEOC rules and how to get pregnant in the military? You better not let this out on the air today, Beowulf, because the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, the PR man, Mr. Mullen, is liable to hear this and put a stop to it immediately.
Yeah, he'll hold a press conference and put the kibosh on it.
Right. They say that this accelerated production of 10 to 12 giant bunker buster bombs is in response to intelligence received of Iranian and North Korean underground nuclear plants. Don't tell that to Mullen.
It's amazing. Even the Saudis are willing to let Israel bomb the Iran nuclear site. Everybody seems to be on board except our own government.
Well, we don't know who our government works for. We all feel that they may be playing for the other side. We don't know who they answer to. We don't. None of us do. In England, Brown slumps to third in a poll in the United Kingdom. Well, that's good hope for me, isn't it? Maybe one day one government will return to England that's actually rational and not a group of pill-popping nanny state, you know, super dads.
It's a matter of time. He's out the next election. No question.
Well, he could always get a job in the Obama administration after they throw him out of England. What could Brown do for Obama? What do you think they could give him? What job? Well, they could give him the job to be the czar of homelessness in America. He could personally go around and give panhandlers permits to beg in America.
But he could be a San Francisco supervisor, maybe.
Well, that's if Obama refuses to hire him. He could be Pat Buchanan's clothier. Brown could help Buchanan design a new kind of waffen uniform.
Armband designer. That's a job description, right?
Armband design. There you go. Right out of the fishbowl.
Yeah. Take over where Goering left off.
I don't think he's smart enough to be Goering. I think he's just a stealth, socialist, pill-popping man who's never done anything except, you know, basically BS the world. And he's way over his head. And the English, even the British are catching on to this. And here in the armpit of America, San Francisco, the headlines are, well, there are no headlines. Nothing. Oh, the Polanski story. The Polanski story. That's an easy target, by the way. He's an easy target. Look, I'm not in favor of Polanski getting away with this, but people are leaving something out of the story. The girl, then 13, was brought in to see Polanski by her mother, who was basically, let us put it to you this way, how shall I say it, pimping off her daughter. The mother brought the daughter in to have sex with Polanski. That came out in court. Also, the girl has been already paid off. That's why she doesn't want to pursue the case. Did you know that, Beowulf?
Yeah, I had heard
that. The girl's like in her 40s now or 50. She got a nice settlement a long time ago because she knows. You know, I read the transcript of the case. The prosecutor even asked her, had she ever had sex before? Yes. Did she know what a quaalude was? Had she used it before? Yes. Now, does that excuse Polanski? No. But the circumstances need to be seen in their context. For one, I mean, I'm all for the guy being tried and exonerating himself in Los Angeles. If he really can prove that he was innocent because he was set up, he didn't know how old she was, you know, that kind of thing. I understand that there is no constitutional right to have sex and there is no constitutional right to rape children. I get it. On the other hand, the girl herself, as I say, was sent in by the mom, some mom, and she was quite an experienced little 13-year-old. Well, what's interesting is that all of the West is up in arms defending Polanski. Oh, my. This child rapist must be allowed free. How dare they take this great artiste and do this to him? After all, he only raped a 13-year-old. These are the same people who refuse to mention
a member of the American media band in Britain. I'm sorry I have to put that in, Beowulf. It belongs here.
No, you're right. It's total hypocrisy. Weigh in on Polanski's behalf, on behalf of a child rapist, but not weigh in on your side. It's insane.
Savage.
The Democrats in Congress have been denouncing the profits made by healthcare companies in order to, well, demonize them and push socialized medicine. Well, I've asked Andrew Biggs from the American Enterprise Institute to join us and tell us why the Democrats are wrong about this. Andrew, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Well, thanks, Michael, for having me on the show. I'm very happy to be here. The Obama administration, the congressional Democratic leadership, have made a tactical decision to demonize health insurance profits as part of their drive to promote health care reform, including greater regulation of the insurance industry, as well as the so-called public option through which the government would provide health insurance directly to the public. The attack plays to Americans' distrust of insurance companies, but it's also untrue. In a recent press conference, President Obama said there have been reports just over the past couple of days of insurance companies making record profits right now. At a time when everybody's getting hammered, they're making record profits and premiums are going up. Likewise, President Obama recently told Congress that insurers cherry-pick the healthiest and thus the lowest cost in individuals while dropping coverage for those who become sick. Insurance executives don't do this because they are bad people, the president said. They do it because it's profitable. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, summing it up as only she can, simply says they are the villains in this.
Are the insurance companies, as Nancy Pelosi believes, the real villains in all of this?
They're not very competent villains. Despite all the hype, the health insurance industry's profit margins remain modest. On average, health insurers deliver a profit of less than 4 cents for each dollar of sales. Health insurance's profit margin is lower than in the soft drink industry, which competes ferociously with advertising. It is less than the fast food industry, which lures you in with dollar menus and supersized meals. And it's far lower than the beer industry, with its profit margin of 18%. And it's not just foodstuffs that earn higher profits than health insurance. Almost 85 other industries have higher profit margins than health insurance. This claim seems at odds with assertions that insurers' profits approached $13 billion last year. Senator Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia said, "I mean, they are making so much money, it's just ridiculous." But Rockefeller, who owes his fortune and, let's face it, his seat in Congress, to his oil magnate great-grandfather, John D. Rockefeller, should know that any large industry will generate significant dollar profits simply by virtue of its size, even if its profit margin is small. But it's the profit margin that matters. Large industries divide profits among millions of investors, each of whom is seeking a decent return on his money.
So what is the problem in the healthcare industry?
The problem with healthcare isn't excessive profits, it's excessive costs. U.S. health system encourages overconsumption, with some experts estimating that up to 30% of health spending is wasted. But the question of profits remains important for two reasons. First, you can often judge politicians' intentions on issues you can't understand, which for most of us includes the vast majority of healthcare policy, by their truthfulness on issues you can understand. If their strategy is based on a claim that is so easily disproved, what will they do in areas you can't check? Second, profit margins in private health insurance should give us pause regarding the so-called public option, which would ostensibly run as a nonprofit.
Will a public option to healthcare result in significant savings, as the Democrat leadership asserts? I don't see how. It means free healthcare for all.
Assuming the only difference between the public option and private health insurance is the need to deliver a profit, the public option would cost only around 4% less than private sector coverage, because 4% is the profit margin that private sector insurers generate. But even this is an overstatement. Private health insurers produce a profit to pay the return demanded by their investors. Instead of relying on private investors, the public option would receive capital from the government. But those funds will be borrowed from private markets, of course, and the taxpayer must pay interest. When interest costs are included, total costs of the public option are about the same as they are for private insurance. Unless, of course, the government option were far more intrusive and heavy-handed than Democratic leaders are currently willing to admit. While a central part of the Democratic leadership's health strategy, demonizing health insurance profits, is a red herring. Health insurance is no more profitable than our dozens of other industry sectors, and it's the free market that keeps it so. That's something to be remembered as the health debate progresses.
Andrew Biggs, thanks for that report and for being on the Savage Nation.
Michael, thanks very much for having me on the Savage Nation this afternoon. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Let's move on. I'm moving boats around as I speak to you. Look, it's my hobby. Boating is my hobby. It's hard for me to repress or suppress the interest I have in the water. It's the one thing on earth that genuinely relaxes me and takes my mind off current events. Let me put it to you that way. Why? Why do I love boating? Because when I'm on a boat and I'm not talking, which is what I go on a boat for, which is why I don't like large groups on a boat. I like me and the dog. Basically, I boated alone for years, the dog and I, Teddy and I. Why? Because when you see the diamonds of light coming at your eyes off the small waves on San Francisco Bay, how in the world can you think about Obama wrecking America? Or when you watch seal pups that were just hatched with the mother seal guiding them, swimming in the bay, and you see this cycle of life year in and year out, how can you worry about Chairman Obama taking a wrecking ball to America? Or when you see a tern diving for a fish. I don't want to wax now already, starting to sound like a parody of myself. You know, I don't want to get into it. But I do this. I mean, I'm a corny guy. I mean, I'm a nature guy. I'm Michael Savage. We'll be right back.
Savage.
Now we're joined by Robert Spencer from Jihad Watch to talk about last Friday's Muslim Day of Prayer in Washington, D.C. We haven't heard much from the media on this. Robert Spencer, can you tell us what happened there?
Yeah, for one thing, 50,000 Muslims were expected to show up. It was clear the Capitol was ready for that many. There was that kind of preparation evident in various ways. But there were only about 3,000 people there, if that many. It was a very peaceful event. I was there for it. The only thing that was a little bit portentous was that there were some pointed criticisms, although they were veiled, they were unmistakable, of Christianity and very open criticisms of Western government and of the American society in the sermon from the Imam Abdul Malik of Brooklyn, New York. And it was clear that the import was, you, America, ought to adopt Islamic law, and that will solve all your problems.
Why do you think the turnout was so small, considering it was projected that there could be as many as 50,000 Muslims in attendance?
The main thing that the media overlooked is that the main American Muslim advocacy groups, the notorious Council on American Islamic Relations and its accomplices like the Muslim Public Affairs Council and the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, they didn't sign on to this. This was the brainchild of a New Jersey mosque and its leader, Hassan Abdullah, and it did not have the backing of the big American Muslim groups, which I believe they are planning to do something themselves that will end up being on a larger scale and will bring out the crowds that they were hoping to bring to this event, but they were not involved with this one.
Well, tell us about your new book.
Michael, the new book is The Complete Infidel's Guide to the Quran, and that is a guide to the threat doctrine, to the enemy's belief system. It is the first book that I have written that explains how it is that Islamic jihadists use the Quran to justify violence, how they find in it a full program, and what we can learn about their motives and goals by looking at the Quran. The biggest failing that we have in all the years since 9/11 is that we have ignored, as a society, as a government, we have ignored and downplayed and denigrated and denied outright the Islamic connection and the Quranic connection to Islamic terrorism. and refuse to take the Islamic terrorists' words at face value when they explain that they're working from the Quran, they're working from Islamic teachings. And so the Quran is something that really we have to know in the spirit of the ancient adage of warfare, know your enemy. And that's what I am trying to do in this book.
We hear from the media that it is only a small percentage of radicals who are creating this environment of fear. Do you feel that this is true?
The facts of the matter, Michael, are that the Quran teaches violence, teaches warfare against unbelievers, teaches Muslims that they have to subjugate non-Muslims under the rule of Islamic law, that the unbelievers are the most vile of created beings, and it's the responsibility of Muslims, who are the best of people on earth, to subjugate them and make sure that they do not have political power in the world. Now, these things are all Quranic doctrine, and there is much more. The Quran says that the Jews are the worst enemies of Allah, which is one indication as to why the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been so intractable, because no peace treaty will be acceptable to the Palestinians when they see the Jews as the enemies of Allah and as their enemies, never to be trusted, never certainly to be lived with as equals in peace. And so the Quran reveals a great deal about the contemporary geopolitical situation. The 9/11 plotters recently wrote a letter to the judge responding to all the charges against them and showing point by point how in every case they were following directives from the Quran. And, of course, this is completely ignored. The obvious upshot of that is that we can look in the Quran and understand what these people are up to and formulate more effective ways to head them off.
Why hasn't this been done already, and why hasn't the media been more vocal about these writings?
Well, if the Quran were not a religious book, that would be a lot easier for a lot of people to take. Then they would have no trouble saying, this book is an exhortation to violence, to supremacism, to warfare, to hatred, and so on. But because it's a religious book, a lot of people assume, well, religions all teach universal brotherhood and peace, and therefore this book must also teach universal brotherhood and peace. And, of course, there's a whole sophisticated and well-financed Islamic PR machine that is claiming that it teaches those things, although anybody that reads it will know better. And at the same time, there is also a great uneasiness on the part of Western multiculturalist leftists to criticize any non-Western system of thought, religious or no, despite their hostility to Western religions.
How do you respond to those who compare the Quran with the Bible?
I'll tell you what. I will look at the Bible as an instrument of hate as soon as there spring up armed groups of Christian terrorists committing terrorist acts all around the world and explaining that they're doing so by reference to Bible verses. There is no such group anywhere around the world. While there are Islamic Jihad groups that are committing violence and terrorism in the name of Islam and justifying it by reference to the Quran all around the world, from Indonesia all across Asia into Africa and Europe and also even in the United States. And so the idea that there is any kind of equivalence there is really kind of wishful thinking on the part of liberals who want to minimize the fact that Islam is unique in this regard. There are violent verses in the Bible, but they are not understood and have not been understood for centuries by any believers as being some kind of marching orders for today, whereas the violent passages in the Quran are almost universally understood by Islamic interpreters of the Quran, by Muslims, as meaning that Muslims have the responsibility to wage war against unbelievers and that that responsibility remains for all time.
How has it been received?
The same old tired things, Michael. People say I'm taking these things out of context. They say that I am misrepresenting the verses. But the book is open. The book is documented. The book is footnoted. Everybody can see how I'm using the sources. Everybody can go to the Quran and see if I am using it improperly. And anybody of goodwill will see that what I'm saying about it is true. There is no one who can actually point to anything and say, what you're saying here, that's actually factually false.
As always, Robert Spencer, thanks for your insights.
Michael, it's a pleasure as always. Thank you very much.
Now we'll take your calls on the Savage Nation. Pennsylvania, Gene, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Mike. Hello.
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead, Gene.
Mike, I've been listening to your program for years, and I'm one of those that are highly addicted to it. But more than that, I just wanted to say something I've been thinking for a long time. You have a very beautiful voice. And you don't say, you know, every 5 minutes.
Oh, my God. I know. There's people who are competing with me who claim to be conservatives who sound like, I'm not going to mention their name because they're not going to get out of the starting gate. But one of these guys has no voice for radio. He sounds like Barbara Boxer's grandmother getting a hysterectomy without anesthesia. And he screeches about being a conservative. I was blessed with an almost biblical, sonorous voice. I was blessed with it since birth. I know that. And I try not to waste it. Thank you for the kind words. Shall I turn into a religious singer? I can get out the drums and the feathers and start tapping the drum and the feather and do a corn dance if you need to become pregnant without going to a... You know. Phil's quick on the uptake today. I'm not laughing at it, man. I'm deeply into a 20,000-year-old culture. Somehow they did very well on the North American continent until the blue coats arrived. So anyway, the new poll, conservatives now outnumber liberals in all 50 states, but you wouldn't know it listening to MSNBC, would you? MSNBC is the most distorted network in the history of the television media. You know, ABC, CBS, NBC are bad enough. We understand their bias going back to Dan Rather and Uncle Walter. Uncle Walter, the wobbly fellow traveler. Uncle Walter, who destroyed the men in Vietnam by shooting them in the back. Shot them in the back. The men fighting there won the Tet Offensive, and that son of a gun had the nerve to say that the war was over because he said so. Read the thing. It's unbelievable. The article's astounding. You got to save that one. While you were at Woodstock, 8,429 miles around the other side of the world, 514,000 mostly young Americans were authentically serving the country that had raised them to play society over self. You got to take your hat off to them.
Savage.
Mind-numbing adulation of Barack Hussein Obama continues unabated. You remember the kids I told you about last week? Well, here's another classroom being brainwashed by their teachers.
Change has come. Change has come.
Hope. Uniting blacks and whites.
Hope.
Being both, Obama cannot take sides.
Hope.
Don't worry, said Hope. I will be your bridge.
In time, Hope will be the bridge for others.
Hope will last enough for you to make a difference.
Change has come. Change has come.
Go now. Fly free.
Study. Watch. Learn. Keep your eyes open.
Education is the key.
Education is the secret.
Education is the way.
Education is the path.
Can I make America better?
Can I make America better?
Can we make America better? Yes. Yes, we can. Yes. Yes, we can.
It's just like the young pioneers in the Soviet Union. But wait. There are even religious services being dedicated to Obama. Wow.
From healthcare systems and industries that place profit over people.
Deliver us, Obama.
From lobbying efforts that block access to quality healthcare for all.
Deliver us, Obama.
From greed and fear that replace the reality of God's abundance and the power of community with the myths of scarcity and isolation.
Deliver us, Obama!
From scapegoatism of immigrants, from blaming the poor, from all sinful attitudes which deem health care as a right of the privileged rather than a basic human right.
Deliver us, Obama!
If this isn't a mental disorder, I don't know what is. And what's the Messiah saying in the meantime? That he doesn't care about victory with Iran?
No, this isn't a football game. So I'm not interested in victory. I'm interested in resolving. The problem is that Iran repeatedly says that it's pursuing nuclear energy only for peaceful purposes, and its actions contradict its words.
And all this time, how are things going in Obama, Chicago? Turns out they caught a gang beating an honor student to death. Black on black crime. Horrible, tragic.
Yeah.
get your stuff in here.
All right, let's move on.
Edelweiss, every morning you greet me.
This song goes out to all the greens in the audience.
Clean and bright.
Why not do it in the road? If it feels good, do it. From 1969 to 2009, one arc, here we are. If it wasn't for drug, sex, and rock and roll, we wouldn't have the Marxists that we have now, the neocoms. Neocom, as opposed to neocon. We got rid of the neocons, now we have the neocoms. Now you got to ask yourself which was worse. That's up to you to decide. Depends on which side of the road you were on, left side, right side, all aboard. Doesn't matter. Who do you worship? I don't know. The important thing to know is that it all ends badly. It does not go out with a bang. It goes out with a whimper. The next thing you wake up and you find out it's a one world order. The dollar is gone. There's a new currency, a new language. It's not Esperanto, but English is dead. And you are a minority in your own country without any civil rights whatsoever. And you have a rotating presidency where there's not even a president anymore. It's sort of a rotating star chamber. Chavez, Obama, Ahmadinejad. You don't even know who's who, but they all look nice because they went to Venice together with Oliver Stone and the red carpet. And they're all movie stars. And what the important thing is that they look good and they march and they're tall. And although they have platform shoes, if they're short, doesn't matter. But they're made to look tall and they act tall because they are tall. Inside, they're taller than God himself. And therefore, the important thing is to not even care about it because Nancy Pelosi, the mother of America, is looking out for you. There is a woman who is continuously smiling. The super smile of Nancy Pelosi, more popular than a speeding bullet. Nancy Pelosi, the politician who wants to bring you. Do you understand that she wants to do you, not bring you? Do you understand that? That the do-gooders will do you every time, that the missionaries went to Hawaii to do good, and they did very well indeed, wound up owning 90% of the land stolen from the Hawaiians, all in the name of doing good. And just as any government that wants to do good will do well, you have to understand that First Lady, the woman who is never seen anymore because she is such a, well, let us say, negative, and therefore they don't show her at all, Michelle Obama. Notice she hasn't been seen. Notice she's the invisible First Lady. Have you noticed that? Have you noticed that? Have you noticed that she is never seen or heard? And have you wondered why that is? Well, one of the reasons is because her Q factor is such that every time she speaks, his ratings go down. And since his ratings are so low and they can't go much lower right now, they have to rush it through and get that socialized medicine in that Ezekiel Emanuel wants so badly in order to make sure that the older man at 65 who has 40 years on the 25-year-old who's lived 40 years longer than a 25-year-old doesn't get the health care that the 25-year-old gets. And so they got to hurry it up, ram it through, pants, suits, ties, unpopular, the people be damned, let them drop dead. And the First Lady now is not seen nor heard, although it turns out that she has 26 servants. The salary is $1.75 million a year just for her servants, not including benefit packages. And it's hard to believe that she has a chief of staff, a deputy assistant to the president, a special assistant to the president, a special assistant director of communications, a deputy chief of the deputy chief, a deputy chief of staff to the chief of staff, a director and press secretary to Michelle, a director of scheduling to Michelle, a deputy director of policy and projects for Michelle, a deputy director and deputy social secretary for Michelle, a deputy director and deputy social secretary for Michelle, a deputy director of scheduling and events coordinator for Michelle, a deputy director of advance and trip director for Michelle, a special assistant and personal aide to Michelle, an associate director and deputy press secretary to Michelle, and a special assistant for scheduling and traveling for Michelle, an associate director of correspondence for Michelle, a deputy associate director of social office for Michelle, an executive assistant to the chief of staff to Michelle, a staff assistant to the social secretary for Michelle, a staff assistant for Michelle, and finally, And last but not least, in the 26 servants for Michelle, a deputy associate director of correspondence for Michelle. This is a woman who wants to, in her own small way, give back to the country that has given her so much. And that's why she left the job at a big law firm for a career in public service. Now, of course, you pay for it, but the important thing is that you don't know you pay for it. And since you don't know you pay for it, it doesn't matter. Let the people be damned. It doesn't matter that she says she's for the people. Well, she is in a way. I'm sure that the 26 servants that she has love her because they're people. Aren't they people? What else would you like to talk about? I actually expect there'll be a giant book burning in America at one point, and the liberals will be behind it. That's why I love the movie Fahrenheit 451. It was so ahead of its time. Who can name who wrote Fahrenheit 451? I can. Anthony Burgess. Is that correct? Oh, Ray Bradbury. I always can. Thank you. Godrick, you got that one right. Only I could have an assistant by the name of Godrick. The short version is God. Old English name. Can I divulge, guys, the relationship now or not? Am I allowed to say anything about it? Beowulf? No, I'm proud to announce. This is amazing. Beowulf Rockland has been my producer for years, and he's really terrific. He's very literate. He knows arcane knowledge that you can't believe. So he has an old English name, Beowulf. About a month ago, I hired his brother, Godrick Rockland. They both have wonderful old English names, and the short version of his name is God. With God's